Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Yesterday was the 95th anniversary of American women finally gaining the right to vote. This program is about that. I will start with the 26th of August, and that's the name of the article, written by Leonora Murray. August 26th is not just another summer day. It is a day of remembrance, a special day honoring three generations of American women who successfully campaigned for 72 years and finally won the basic right of citizenship, the right to vote. The 19th Amendment became a part of the United States Constitution on August 26, 1920. After 72 years of struggle, American women have had suffrage for 95 years. One wonders how long it will take to pass the Equal Rights Amendment. Susan B. Anthony went to jail because she attempted to vote. A federal judge told her, if we men, we would say women. So who says we don't need the ERA? I think all of us on the North Coast have feminist ancestors who endured ridicule, derision, distortion, verbal and physical assaults to gain equality. We all have grandmothers, mothers, aunts, sisters, wives, daughters, sweethearts, and cousins, women who got thrown in jail for joining strikes, who got fired when asking for equal wages, who were denied access to training and education on the basis of sex, who marched and demonstrated, who still march and demonstrate. Will you remember them on August 26th? Let's remember our folk heroes, the women who attended the first Equal Rights Conference in New York and published the Seneca Falls Declaration in 1848, the women who joined the Women's Party that Alice Paul founded, the women who were blue-collar workers and union organizers. Let's remember them all with love. Let's celebrate. Let's celebrate the gutsy Dr. Mary Wright, Congressional Medal of Honor winner. She was a battlefield surgeon for the Union Army. 50 years later, Congress decided she hadn't been brave enough, so they requested the medal be returned. She refused, so Congress denied her military pension. Unfortunately, nobody bothered to take down her exact words, but they must have been dillies to make Congress take such strong action against her. After all, she was still a veteran, entitled to her pension. Let's celebrate ex-slave Sojourner Truth. Her speech, "Ain't I a Woman," made history when she asked if women were frail and weak, how come nobody kept her from working as a field hand? And if motherhood and women's sensitivity precluded them from public life, then where was everybody when her five children were sold into slavery? Nobody worried about her sensitivity. And "Ain't I a Woman?" She sure was. And in another instance, she faced down a Bible-quoting mob, saying she did indeed believe in Jesus, but you men didn't have nothing to do with Jesus. That was between God and women. No men anywhere. A very nice lady. A very tough lady. And let's not forget Sacagawea, pathfinder for Lewis and Clark, or Luch Stone, who made up her own wedding vows and kept her own name. Or Jane Addams, not only a great humanitarian, but first American to win the Nobel Prize, and who insisted that her husband realize that more than just men were equal. Or Elizabeth Cady Stanton, or Abigail Adams, or Oregon's own Agnes Theia Fair, Abigail Scott Duniway, Dr. Marie Ikwe, Julia Rutila from Astoria, or Amelia Bloomer, who tried so damned hard to make sense out of fashion. Now that lady would be in rat heaven to see jeans as an acceptable garment. I think our libraries need at least one set of American women of history. Her story. Without the women I mentioned are just, without it, the women I mentioned are just a splash in the ocean. And most of all, let's celebrate the grand old lady, Susan B. Anthony, who said, "Failure is impossible." We believe it. If it takes another 72 years to get women written into the National Constitution, and consciousness, we're ready. But I don't think our politicians are. Stanton didn't forget men either. On men's liberation, she said, "Of course, for are not men the children of women?" And most heartening and solemn of all, Susan B. Anthony said, "Until women have the same rights as men on this green earth, there shall never be another season of silence." Amen. Let's all support our local daycare centers. Join the local chapter of the National Organization for Women now. Support our women's crisis centers. And best of all, celebrate our gallant women. August 26th, celebrate the 95th anniversary of women's right to vote. Leonora Murray wrote this article to celebrate the 60th anniversary of women's right to vote for the North Coast Times Eagle in 1980. Now, I'd like to read something on the same subject which I wrote. And believe me, I thank very much the Timelines of American Women's History by Sue Heinemann, which has been indispensable. I call it Women's Equality Day. The major necessity of the 21st century is to achieve the political, social, and personal equality of women, which transcends every other pressing inequity, because it is the most basic correction for humanity to make, as well as the most potent force to successfully fulfill virtually everything else that needs to be done. Though we are a single species, our genders have separate stories. Fundamentally, one is of life, the other of death. Of persuasion and connection versus force and supremacy. The male gender is out of whack. So suffused with dominance and control, it is the major danger to the survival of the species and also to life on the planet. The leavening influence of women is most likely the real key to our future on the planet as a world society and thriving species. Women were, after all, the irrefutable pioneers of the cultivation of grains and domestication of animals that produced civilization in the first place. The deceit that half the human race is unequal and subordinate to the other half is a persistent malignancy. It has been chronic throughout history, especially in periods when muscle and force held sensitivity and intelligence in thrall. Yet the need to be equal and free is the most stubborn human yearning. It has taken centuries for women to emerge from the dominance of their male counterparts. It took nearly a century for American women to gain the right to vote after it was, at long last, allowed to be introduced to Congress in 1878, exactly 91 years after the U.S. Constitution was adopted. The nation has been saddled with the swagger of blustering maleness despite a popular majority of women voters whose political endeavors are too often denied by fraud and corruption at virtually every level of male assertion of power. Women have contributed hugely to American history, but as with blacks and others who have helped build the nation, their contributions have been ignored or undervalued. Yesterday was commemorated as Women's Equality Day in the USA because American women have had the vote for 95 years, since August 26, 1920. The bitter fight for equal suffrage with men lasted three quarters of a century. Yet, as the current reactionary, primarily right-wing, war against women indicates, it is not by any stretch lived up to its claim for equal rights. The fact that women voted for the first time in equal numbers as men in 1980 and have often since voted in greater numbers than men has not altered male dominance of political power. Although women generally vote differently than men, they do not necessarily vote for women. Yet election year 1992 was significant because women campaigned in unprecedented numbers for every conceivable office in the country, local, state, and federal, including at least one woman for president. Women entered politics backed by other women, finally using their majority power to elect women to public office. Eleanor Roosevelt was adamant. Women must get into the political game and stay in it. In 1787, the new United States Constitution left the determination of who was eligible to vote to the states, but did not specifically bar women from holding federal office. States' rights meant then, as now, limited participation, or none, by those outside the white male status quo. New Jersey's state constitution gave the vote to all property owners worth a certain amount, which left wives as well as unmarried women ineligible. However, the state's election law was briefly revised in 1790 and referred to voters as he or she. New York specifically denied voting rights to women in its constitution in 1777, and other states quickly followed suit. Thomas Jefferson, principal author of the Declaration of Independence, said as president in response to a suggestion in 1807 by Secretary of the Treasury Albert Gallatin, "The appointment of a woman to office is an innovation for which the public is not prepared, nor am I." The 19th century began with women voting in substantial numbers in the 1800 presidential election, but in 1807, New Jersey changed its election law once more by inserting the words white and male into its voting requirements, and women were not permitted to hold public office in any of the states. In the summer of 1848, the Seneca Falls Convention, perhaps the most famous gathering of American women in the 19th century, was held in Seneca Falls, New York. Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Lucretia Mott, Martha Coffin Wright, Jane Hunt, and Mary Ann McClintock were the principal organizers and were surprised that almost 300 people, mostly women, attended. A declaration of sentiments was drafted by Stanton at the convention, modeled after the Declaration of Independence. It condemned women's disenfranchisement, their lack of a voice in the laws they were compelled to obey, restrictions on their education and employment opportunities, their subordination by the church, the use of a moral double standard, and the theft of married women's full property rights. The group then passed a series of general resolutions that called for women's equal rights. A proposal to secure the vote for women narrowly passed after arguments by Stanton and former slave and black abolitionist Frederick Douglass, but took more than 70 years to be fulfilled. Only one woman who signed the resolution, Charlotte Woodward, later Pierce, lived to cast her ballot. She was 19 at Seneca Falls. The Civil War, as it did every facet of American society, altered the structure and goals of the feminist movement, which began to concentrate primarily on women's suffrage as the process through which every other form of equity would be certified. In May 1866, men and women from the American Anti-Slavery Society and women's rights groups joined forces to form the American Equal Rights Association in New York. With Lucretia Mott as president and Susan B. Anthony as corresponding secretary, the group began a campaign for suffrage for all African Americans and all women. Thousands of women signed a petition drafted by Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton that demanded Congress initiate a constitutional amendment to, quote, prohibit the several states from disenfranchising any of their citizens on the grounds of sex, unquote. Congress passed the 14th Amendment in 1866, and it was ratified in 1868. It stated that all persons born or naturalized in the United States were citizens and guaranteed due process and equal protection under the law. However, another section referred to voting rights in terms of male citizens, the first time this qualification appeared in the Constitution. And as we know, the 14th Amendment right now is again considerably controversial. Elizabeth Cady Stanton ran for Congress that year, 1866, though she was not allowed to vote, and although she received only 24 votes of 12,000 cast, she proved women had the right to campaign for public office. Stanton and Anthony formed the National Women's Suffrage Association, NWSA, to push for a constitutional amendment guaranteeing women the vote in 1869. Later that year, Lucy Stone, Julia Ward Howe, and others established a counter group, the American Women's Suffrage Association, AWSA. The two groups were rivals for 20 years. The NWSA was generally the more radical, advocating not just the vote, but also reforms in women's wages, working conditions, and property and divorce laws. The AWSA focused on women's suffrage, working at the state rather than federal level. In December 1869, Wyoming Territory granted women suffrage in its new constitution. The legislature also guaranteed married women's rights to their own property and approved equal pay for male and female teachers. The following year, Utah Territory gave the vote to women, took it away in 1887, and restored it in 1896. Colorado's women got the vote in 1893 after prominent local socialites joined the state suffrage movement. By 1896, four contiguous states, Idaho, Wyoming, Colorado, and Utah, had full suffrage, but no other state would for 14 more years. In 1890, Congress attempted to deny Wyoming's application for statehood because it allowed women to vote, but in a close vote admitted it as the only state in which women could vote in a federal election. Women pushed for their rights to vote in elections all over the country in the late 19th century, and Victoria Woodhull became the first woman to campaign for the presidency in 1872, forming her own Equal Rights Party. Susan B. Anthony and 16 other women were arrested in Rochester, New York that year when they tried to vote in the presidential election. Anthony declared, "It is we, the people, not we, the white male citizens, nor we, the male citizens, but we, the whole people, who formed this union. We formed it not to give the blessings of liberty, but to secure them, not to half of ourselves and the half of our posterity, but to the whole people, women as well as men. It is downright mockery to talk of women of their enjoyment of the blessings of liberty while they are denied the only means of securing them provided by the Democratic Republican government, the ballot." Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton managed to get Congress to vote on a constitutional suffrage amendment in 1878. Called the Anthony Amendment, it was reintroduced every year for the next 41 years until it became the 19th Amendment. It states simply, "The right of citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or any state on account of sex." The Senate waited 9 years to debate and vote on the Anthony Amendment, with 16 for, 34 against, and 26 absent in 1887. The Senate did nothing more until March 1914, when for the first time in 27 years, the amendment was brought out of committee to vote on it again, with 35 for and 34 against. That same year, activist teacher Harriet Rodman formed the Feminist Alliance, which demanded, quote, "The removal of all social, political, and other discriminations which are based on sex, and the award of all rights and duties in all fields on the basis of individual capacity alone." After President Woodrow Wilson spoke out in favor of the Anthony Amendment in January 1918, the House of Representatives passed the measure for the first time, 274 for, 136 against, just the two-thirds required majority. Despite a direct plea by Wilson, the Senate defeated it by two votes. In regard to state suffrage, by 1910, Oregon had failed to pass five such referendums, but that same year, Washington became the first state since 1896 to grant women the vote, approving the measure by almost 2-1. In 1911, suffragists mounted an intense campaign in California, and by 3,857 votes against votes, the state's women won the right to cast their own ballots. In 1914, suffrage was on the ballot in seven states. Defeated in Missouri, Nebraska, Ohio, North and South Dakota, it won in Montana and Nevada. Four East Coast states voted down suffrage in 1915. They were Massachusetts, New Jersey, New York, and Pennsylvania. 2 years later, New York overturned the earlier vote and became the first East Coast state to grant women suffrage. Also that year, 1917, women gained the right to vote after legislative action in six states: Indiana, Michigan, Nebraska, North Dakota, Ohio, and Rhode Island. Women also won the right to vote in primaries in Arkansas. Michigan, Oklahoma, and South Dakota gained full suffrage the following year, and in Texas, women were allowed to vote in primaries through legislative action, though literacy tests prevented many Black and Mexican American women from voting. The U.S. House of Representatives approved the 19th Amendment in May 1919, 304-89, after a lame duck Senate defeated it in February that year. The Senate finally reversed its long rejection to women's suffrage in June with a vote of 66-30. Within 1 week, three states, Wisconsin, Illinois, and Michigan, ratified the amendment, and by the end of the year, more than 20 states had passed the measure. By the end of March 1920, 35 of the required 36 states had ratified the amendment. A single vote in the Tennessee House of Representatives in August, Harry Byrne, whose mother was a suffragist and told him to be a good boy and vote for ratification, gave the Constitution its 19th Amendment, which was declared official on August 26th. Two other states, Vermont and Connecticut, ratified it later. 10 states did not ratify the 19th Amendment. They are Alabama, Delaware, Florida, Georgia, Louisiana, Maryland, Mississippi, Virginia, North and South Carolina. Of the 38 states that approved it, they were more than the 3/4 states needed to pass it. Carrie Chapman Catt and Nettie Rogers wrote a book in 1923, Women's Suffrage and Politics, The Inner Story of the Suffrage Movement, in which they asked, why the delay? We think we have the answer, they wrote. It was not an antagonistic public sentiment, nor yet an uneducated or indifferent public sentiment. It was the control of public sentiment, the deflecting and thwarting of public sentiment through the trading and the trickery, the buying and selling of American politics. We think that we can prove it. It should be understood that the long, exhaustive fight for women's suffrage was hardly entirely legislative. It involved many thousands of marches, demonstrations, and rallies, which were numerous times violently disrupted by rioting men, club-swinging police, and massive arrests of women and male supporters. And almost immediately after the suffrage victory, another crucial and long-drawn-out struggle for the equality of women began. At a National Women's Party convention in 1921, Alice Paul introduced what she said was the next women's rights issue, passage of an equal rights amendment. In 1923, the NWP started a new journal, Equal Rights, edited by Edith Houghton Hooker, and introduced its equal rights amendment, nicknamed the Lucretia Mott Amendment, into Congress. This bill, which failed, stated, quote, men and women shall have equal rights throughout the United States and every place subject to its jurisdiction, unquote. Many women's groups and labor activists opposed the bill because it eliminated hard-won protective legislation for women workers. Indeed, the U.S. Supreme Court invalidated a minimum wage law because it did not give men and women equal rights. Reintroduced into the House of Representatives by Congresswoman Hattie Caraway 20 years later, in 1943, the ERA was changed to read, equality of rights under the law shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex. Again failing to pass, women in several states set up ERA committees that lobbied state legislatures to pressure Congress. The Senate voted on the ERA for the first time in more than 20 years in 1947. The count of 38 for and 35 against was far short of the two-thirds majority needed. In 1967, the National Organization for Women, NOW, made as one of eight demands included in its Bill of Rights, immediate passage of the Equal Rights Amendment, quote, unquote. Finally, in 1970, the House approved the ERA, 350-15, after only an hour debate, following Representative Martha Griffith's successful effort to get it out of the Judiciary Committee. But the state refused to vote on the ERA until 1972, following intense lobbying by women's groups, especially now. The measure was approved 84-8. By the end of the year, 22 states, led by Hawaii, ratified the amendment. In addition, 6 states, Colorado, Hawaii, Maryland, New Mexico, Washington, and Texas, added equal rights amendments to their state constitutions, preceded by Pennsylvania the year before. However, by 1978, Congress was urged to extend the ratification deadline beyond March 1979 because a shortfall of 35 out of required 38 states had ratified the ERA. 7 more years were requested, but Congress extended the deadline only 4 years to June 30, 1982. ERA supporters not only fought campaigns to pass ERA in the states, but also campaigns to rescind it. In 1979, NOW and other groups managed to head off attempts to revoke ERA ratification in 13 states, but were unable to gain any new states. The necessary 3 states never ratified the ERA, although polls showed that 63% of the public supported it, with only 32 opposed. 15 states rejected the ERA, and 4 others attempted to rescind their support, but the move was thought to be unconstitutional. Among the spurious arguments used to defeat the ERA were the specter of women being drafted and forced to serve in combat, a potential loss of alimony and child custody preference in divorce cases, and the possibility that tax money would have to be used for abortions. Anti-feminists also put forth absurd but highly symbolic scenarios, such as unisex toilets. Right-wing women such as Phyllis Schlafly and her Eagle Forum, dedicated to, quote, family rights and, again, quote, law and order, considerably upset the ERA campaign. The ERA failed even though it had majority support throughout the country. The ERA has been prematurely sent to the grave more than once since 1923. On July 14, 1982, the same month as ERA's failure to be ratified on deadline, 51 U.S. senators and 201 House representatives co-sponsored the ERA in both houses of Congress. That attempt also failed. A national referendum would probably make the ERA law within a few months. Instead, when revived again, and it will be, it must once more travel the torturously long trail through the states, 38 of which must ratify it into law. Even the most optimistic believe it will take years. One possibility to encourage the process of making the ERA a part of the Constitution is for women to vote all who oppose it from office and support only candidates who will endorse it. As Eleanor Smeal, former head of NOW, wrote in 1982, the best way to assure recognition of women's political concerns is to elect office holders who are not only pro-women's issues, but are women themselves. The quickest way for us to elect more women to public office is for more women to run as candidates. An excellent reason for women to get into politics is that they generally represent the most generous and humane prospects of humanity. Women are literally pregnant with our future and provide the true compassion and Gaia wisdom of our species. In the words of Susan B. Anthony, there shall never be another season of silence until women have the same rights men have on this green. This has been Michael McCusker, and I hope you all had a great Women's Equality Day yesterday.